From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report. Surprise! Governor Ron DeSantis calls a special session of the Florida legislature to oppose government employee vaccine mandates from the feds.
In Florida, your right to earn a living is not contingent upon whatever choices you're making.
Also this week, several Florida school districts battle a state rule banning local student mask mandates.
What this rule really does is prevents school districts from requiring masks without
parental. We'll also hear about improving jobless numbers for Florida, although the state's troubled unemployment system still has problems, and another Democrat enters the race for Florida governor. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Well, the top news of the week kind of came from out of nowhere. Governor Ron DeSantis on Thursday called for a special legislative session next month to push back against White House attempts to require workers to be vaccinated against COVID-19. The exact dates of the special session aren't known yet. However, lawmakers are scheduled to be in Tallahassee for committee meetings the weeks of November 1st, 15th, and 29th. The governor wants legislation passed to make it illegal for governments to mandate vaccines for government employees, to make those fired for refusing an employer-required COVID-19 vaccine to be eligible for reemployment assistance, and also to say employees would be eligible for workers' comp coverage if they get sick because of employer-related vaccinations. DeSantis said the state cannot wait until the 2022 legislative session, which begins in January, to strengthen state laws.
We want to make it clear that in Florida, your right to earn a living is not contingent upon whatever choices you're making in terms of these injections.
Democrats, including State Representative Anna Eskamani, immediately blasted DeSantis' announcement, calling it a political ploy.
The fact that Governor DeSantis is going to be spending public money and time on a politically motivated agenda to boost his own campaign aspirations is disappointing. It's sad.
DeSantis's proposal also seeks to allow fired workers to sue employers that fail to provide notices of religious and health exemptions, and also to give more protections to parents who disagree with school districts regarding coronavirus restrictions. While not specifically commenting on the governor's asks for the special session, House Speaker Chris Sprouse and Senate President Wilton Simpson issued a joint statement in which they said, "Florida will respond to this gross overreach by the federal government." They indicated lawmakers could consider withdrawing the state from the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration. It's been working on rules to require vaccinations for many workers across the country. Such a proposal would involve establishing a state program for worker safety. "We believe by doing so, Florida will have the ability to alleviate onerous federal regulations placed on employers and employees," Sprouse and Simpson said in the statement. An administrative law judge is weighing a Department of Health rule governing school mask mandates. The two-day trial kicked off on Thursday of this week in Tallahassee. Lynn Hatter reports the districts argued the state overstepped its authority when it issued the rule, but the state said those claims are overblown. And a note about the audio. The hearing was broadcast over Zoom, but the attorneys were not properly mic'd up, and some of their remarks may be a little tough to hear.
Six school districts are suing the state. They say the Department of Health's basis for issuing a rule giving parents the right to opt out of mask mandates is wrong. The department first issued the emergency rule in August and clarified and replaced it near the end of September, a time when the district's attorney, Jamie Cole, says COVID cases were dropping.
One of our positions is going to be that it is not an immediate danger. COVID is not an immediate danger because there was nothing unforeseeable happening, nothing urgent, nothing had happened in the prior couple of weeks to necessitate an emergency procedure such as this.
Cole says by issuing an emergency order, the department dodged the rulemaking process, which requires public notice and hearings to allow for input. And he argues the department's rule is out of bounds because it does not address controlling communicable diseases.
They did kind of the opposite. They said what this rule really does is school prevents school districts from requiring masks without parental opt-out to their sole discretion. And the question is, does that control COVID?
The state's attorney, Jason Gonzalez, says the health department did not need to be in a state of emergency to issue an emergency order regarding the use of face masks on children in school.
We didn't need a state of emergency. We certainly didn't need to waive a statute because we have a statute granting that rulemaking authority. So if you hear that come up again, there is just no merit to that argument. I think it's just a misunderstanding of what the executive power to declare a state of emergency actually is.
Gonzalez says the school districts are wrong about quite a few things, like the argument that the health department exceeded its authority when it crafted the rule giving parents the sole right to opt their students out of face coverings. Gonzalez says the state did not ban masks.
This rule provides that the districts may, at their option, they may adopt a masking policy. And the department chose to draw the line on what type of masking policy by saying that you can have a masking policy, but we're going to place a limit on that. And what the limit is, you have to allow a parental opt-out.
And he argues against another claim, that the rule was inspired by the Parents' Bill of Rights, a new law that says parents have the ultimate say over the health care decisions for their children. That law has been at the forefront of the lawsuits over face masks. Governor Ron DeSantis cited it in his executive order attempting to ban mask mandates. And that executive order was released right before the health department issued its mask rules. I'm Len Hatter.
Dealing a win to Governor Ron DeSantis and the Seminole tribe, a federal judge this week dismissed a lawsuit challenging a gambling agreement that allows the tribe to have control over sports betting in Florida. Owners of the Paramutuals, Magic City Casino in Miami-Dade County, and Bonita Springs Poker Room in Southwest Florida filed the lawsuit in July after lawmakers approved the wide-ranging gambling deal between the state and the tribe. Part of the deal, known as a compact, calls for the tribe to operate sports betting, with gamblers throughout the state able to place bets online. The Paramutuals contend that allowing people to place sports bets while off tribal property will violate federal laws. While we're talking sports, football programs could come to Florida's state college system after top education officials this week repealed a rule that has prohibited colleges from having teams. But it's likely schools will launch flag football teams to start. The State Board of Education approved repealing the decades-old rule. Rob Cheney, the Associate Director and Athletics Commissioner for the Florida College System Activities Association, said the change is likely a move to set up the creation of women's flag football teams on state college campuses. Still to come on Capitol Report, a Texas-style abortion bill looks unlikely to move forward in Florida.
I do not support citizen enforcement of any kind of laws because I think that's a slippery slope.
Florida's jobless rate keeps inching downwards. That's really a good thing because it seems the state's unemployment system is still fraught with problems.
This is a situation where DO is accusing someone of receiving money that they should not have received.
Florida's retirement system has been long considered a model for the rest of the nation, and we'll hear from the man who helped make it so.
We were on a buying spree when everybody else was terrified and selling, and we've been getting paid for it ever since.
And we'll also hear from a Democratic strategist on how State Senator Annette Tadeo's recent candidacy for governor could help the party's chances for success heading into 2022.
It's healthy on our side as we rebuild in this state to have a lot of interesting and diverse voices in the conversation.
When a Republican state House member filed a Texas-style abortion bill in Florida last month, activists called the move potentially devastating. But now Regan McCarthy reports even the staunchest supporters of abortion regulation say the measure is unlikely to move forward.
I like the fact that it's creative. I like the fact that it shut down abortions and slowed them down for at least a period of time and protected unborn children.
John Stenberger is president of the Florida Family Policy Council, an organization that supports greater abortion regulation. He says while there are things he likes about the Texas law, there are also things he doesn't like, namely that he's not sure it will pass a full constitutional challenge before the U.S. Supreme Court.
It survived what we call a facial challenge, where you're just looking at the face of the statute and asking, is this constitutional? And five of the nine members of the U.S. Supreme Court said, yes, it is constitutional, because there's no state action. In other words, there's no fine, there's no penalty by the state, there's no misdemeanor or felony. It allowed private action.
The new Texas law prohibits abortions after a fetal heartbeat can be detected, usually at about 6 weeks. And it lets private citizens sue anyone who helps a person seek an abortion after that point. Stenberger says the provision that allows private citizens to bring causes of action is similar to something that's already in place for some civil rights cases. One difference is the Texas law allows lawsuits even from people who are not directly related to the case.
So that's nothing new, but I don't think that's going to be held to be constitutional in the end. So I think that's one of the many reasons why you're not going to see that bill come out here in Florida.
Stenberger says another reason is that the governor and Senate leaders are now indicating they're unlikely to support it. One of their biggest concerns is the provision that allows citizen enforcement. Naples Republican Senator Kathleen Pasadomo talked about that following her recent election as Senate President Designate.
I do not support citizen enforcement of any kind of laws because I think that's a slippery slope. And that's why we have the courts.
Then there's Florida's Constitution.
I'm a lawyer, and I know what Florida Constitution provides, and there's a right to privacy. And the question is, when does the state's compelling interest begin? And so right now, the Florida Supreme Court, I think it was in a case in the 1980s, ruled that viability was defining benchmark, and then it was determined to be 24 weeks. I think we can look at that.
Lawmakers in both parties have said while they don't expect a Texas-style bill to move forward this year, they are expecting a comprehensive abortion bill. Stenberger says he wouldn't be surprised to see legislation that moves restrictions on abortions in Florida to an earlier stage of pregnancy, especially as a case heads before the U.S. Supreme Court that addresses the constitutionality of banning pre-viability abortions. He also says the new, more conservative makeup of Florida's Supreme Court could eventually play a role. He questions a previous ruling on Florida's privacy clause. The clause was first passed as an attempt to protect information as technology like bank transfers and fax machines developed, but it's since been used to block several previous abortion-related bills.
We now have a very clear-thinking, textualist constitution, Florida Supreme Court, and I think that if there is a bill and it's challenged and brought before them, I think that they'll make a correct decision in realizing this was never intended to confer a right to abortion.
Whatever happens, it won't happen quietly. Florida Planned Parenthood Executive Director Laura Goodhue says her group is already geared up to protect the bodily autonomy of pregnant people, despite some concerns about how the ongoing pandemic could impact the upcoming legislative session.
We will work to get the voices of pregnant people, people that have made, that have had abortions, to talk about their experiences, and they won't silence us. There's no way. We've been fighting for 50 years, and we're not going to stop now.
I'm Regan McCarthy.
As more Floridians go back to work, issues remain with the state's unemployment assistance program. Robbie Gaffney reports.
The Department of Economic Opportunity, or DEO, says of the jobs initially lost during the pandemic, nearly 84% have been recovered. In addition, the agency's chief economist, Adrian Johnston, says for certain jobs, there are more people in the labor force now than in February of last year.
The construction sector added 6,900 jobs in September, joining financial services and professional business services in surpassing its employment numbers from February of 2020 prior to the pandemic. Except for leisure and hospitality, All private sector industries have recovered at least 80% of jobs compared to their February 2020 employment numbers.
The state ended its participation in federal unemployment benefits in June, 3 months early, as part of an effort to get more people back into the workforce. Governor Ron DeSantis says in April of last year, he was supportive of getting money out to people.
What were they supposed to do? It wasn't their fault. A lot of people were laid off, and it wasn't like you could just go get a job. Well, now we're in a situation where anyone that wants a job in Florida get a job.
In September, the state's unemployment rate was nearly 5%, placing Florida as the 29th lowest state for unemployment.
I mean, the goal is to stabilize, make sure you don't fall through the cracks, and then get you back into the workforce. And clearly, right now, we have opportunities to do it.
But Orlando Democratic Representative Anna Escamani says people are falling through the cracks.
You know, we're seeing a lot of folks apply for jobs at fast food restaurants and not get them because they're overqualified. At that same token, we see folks that can't afford some of the jobs available because they don't pay enough.
Escamani's office has been helping Floridians navigate the state's unemployment assistance system. She says many issues that plague the system are longstanding. They include delayed processing and people getting locked out of their accounts. But Escamani says one new change is people are now getting letters from DEO stating they owe money.
This is a situation where DEO is accusing someone of receiving money that they should not have received. And it could be due to they weren't actually eligible for benefits, so everything they were paid was an overpayment. Or it could be that their base pay that determines weekly benefit amount is actually lower than what was originally calculated.
Escamani says the letters are creating a lot of fear and confusion.
Especially for Floridians that have language barriers who get this letter in English. That also says there's going to be a collection agency that comes after them. And you know, for many Floridians in this situation, this is their first time ever collecting unemployment.
The state says it's legally required to send the letters. But if someone received more than they should have, DEO submitted a request to Florida's chief financial officer requesting the state not send claimants to collections. But that's only good for non-fraudulent debt and for people who collected unemployment between March of 2020 through September of this year. I'm Robbie Gaffney.
As head of the State Board of Administration, Ash Williams managed billions of dollars worth of state investments, including state worker pensions. Williams held the job for 5 years in the 1990s, then went to the private sector. He was lured back to Florida in 2008 in the midst of an economic crisis. Williams retired last month. Gina Jordan sat down with him to talk about Florida's finances and why he agreed to return as the chief investor of state funds during a recession.
Many people took the view that assuming this role at that time would be an extraordinarily risky, if not foolhardy, enterprise. And the reality of it was exactly the opposite. At that point in time, we were literally staring into the financial abyss. It was unclear whether global financial systems could survive or not. It really was that big a question. I've never seen anything like it, and I've been around for quite a while. So I knew from my experience that the best time to invest is when there is raw terror in the minds of investors all over the world. And as a famous economist once said, the best time to invest is when there's blood running in the streets and there's utter mayhem in society. And that's right where we were. My thinking was, listen, if we can be a disciplined buyer with liquidity and capital depth and focus, we can, in a very cool and disciplined way, make a series of investments that are going to pay our bills for the next 20 years. And that's exactly what we did. We went on a buying spree when everybody else was terrified and selling, and we've been getting paid for it ever since.
So your job involved overseeing $250 billion in state funds for retirement, for hurricane recovery, for local governments. That sounds very stressful. Was it stressful?
At times, anything will be stressful. And you mentioned $250 billion. That's where we are now. The fund bottomed in March of 2009 at about just a little over $88 billion. And I remember at the time we were under an assault politically and in the press. Lots of questioning, lots of doubt. We knew we were doing the right things for the right reasons. And it was just a question of letting things play out, long enough to see the benefit of our efforts. We returned an annualized 10.33% over that long period of time, and none of that is an accident.
And the big question is, how did he do it? How did he do it during a recession? How did he do it during a pandemic?
That environment is when you want to be an aggressive buyer. That's the difference between individual investors who tend to be emotionally driven and institutions who can be coldly rational, and bad times are to be celebrated because bad times bring opportunities. As you age, you can take less risk, so you own less stocks, you own more bonds. Well, that's a real limiter to the way individuals can invest their capital. With an institution, if you think about the Florida retirement system, we have over 1 million beneficiaries in the FRS, and you're combining the mortality risk of that huge pool of people. You've got young people who've just come into the system, you've got older people who are nearing retirement, and then you've got old people who have been retired for many years. And as a result of pooling that mortality, you have a constant ability to tolerate volatility. And that's part of the secret sauce of the SBA. We have the ability to always take that long-term view, and we don't have the problem the individual has. And that's the difference between an institutional mindset and an individual one.
So you're leaving on a high note.
Timing is everything, and they always say get off the stage while the audience is on their feet. You know, coming in a crisis and leaving at all-time market highs can make the dumbest person in the world look smart.
Do you have any parting words for us or for lawmakers?
Well, I would just say broadly that in modern times, the government is often talked about as an evil, and government employees are generally thought of not in the brightest light. And I just don't think that's right. I mean, if you think about it, when we have crises, whether it's a pandemic, whether it's a hurricane or tornado or fires or, God forbid, a war, who is it that gets us out of that ditch? When things really go bad, people look to the government to save them. As corny as it may sound, there's honor in public service. I would encourage young people to consider public service and what they can add, to make things better and to contribute. Having spent a good part of my career taking care of the retirement income of the 1 million people in Florida who chose to give their lives to public service is a good thing, and I'm proud to have done it.
Ash Williams, former head of the Florida State Board of Administration, now retired from the state. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Gina.
If you'd like to hear Gina's entire interview with Ash Williams, you can find it at WFSU.org. The State Board of Education is considering adopting a proposal aimed at reshaping the way civics education is taught in public schools that would culminate an effort set in motion by lawmakers this spring. Making changes that inject patriotism into the curriculum was a top priority of top Republican lawmakers and Governor Ron DeSantis during the legislative session that ended back in April. DeSantis signed a measure into law in June that called for giving Florida students an understanding of the civic-minded expectations developed by the State Board of Education of an upright and desirable citizenry that recognizes and accepts responsibility for preserving and defending the blessings of liberty inherited from prior generations and secured by the United States Constitution. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Florida's Democratic primary race for governor has three high-profile contenders after Senator Annette Tedeo of Miami-Dade County announced her candidacy earlier this week. Tedeo is vying for the party's nomination against Congressman Charlie Crist and State Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Freed. Valerie Crowder spoke with longtime Democratic strategist Steve Shale about what this means for the race heading into next year's elections.
What does State Senator Annette Tedeo's campaign announcement mean for the Democratic primary race for governor?
When you look back at 2020, one of the real places where things kind of got sideways for Democrats was with the Hispanic vote, particularly in South Florida. And Annette represents a a swing district that is majority Hispanic. I think it's a, it's an important voice. I think that's one element she brings to it. You know, secondly, she's, you know, she's a businesswoman. So she's got, again, kind of a little bit of a different, different sort of background, a little different sort of story to get there. And I think it's healthy on our side as we rebuild in this state to have a lot of interesting and diverse voices in the conversation.
What do you make of the fact that Tadeo ran for lieutenant governor alongside Congressman Charlie Crist when he was seeking the governor's office in 2014 and now is running against him in the primary?
I mean, I don't make much of it. I mean, I think Congressman Crist and Senator Tadeo, I have no reason to believe they're not friendly and not friends. But there's only one governor's mansion. And, you know, and so if you're going to run, you're going to run. And, you know, frankly, I think all three of them in the race are probably pretty friendly. So Annette and Charlie are friends, as far as I know. I think the three of them, including Nikki, all three of them get along very well. And I have a lot of confidence that given their personal relationships, whoever's the nominee, the other two are going to rally behind them pretty quickly. So I don't read much into it at all.
Do you expect Tadeo's candidacy will spur more Democrats to join the race?
It's hard to say. I mean, we're still probably, 7 months away, 8 months away to qualifying. Certainly in 2018, we saw some late entries in the race. And so I think it's probably too early to say that the field is closed. I haven't heard of anybody, at least who's on the elected side, actively looking at getting in at this point. But that doesn't mean there's not someone out there or sort of a business type person or self-funder that couldn't get in yet. But I think for the most part, this is probably our field.
What do you think Democrats need to do to put themselves in a competitive position to win a statewide race next year?
We were able to win a number of statewide races in 2006 and 2008, coming off of a really horrible presidential cycle in 2004. And we did it by getting back and focusing on sort of basics, registering voters in a real way, which we really haven't done well as a party for a while, kind of getting back to meeting voters where they are. I mean, obviously, we need to do better with Hispanics in Miami-Dade, for example, but we also need to do better with suburban and ex-urban voters. And so in 2004, George Bush won the state by 5 points, and Democrats won three of the next six statewide elections over the next two cycles. And so I certainly don't think that all is lost, but, you know, we got to get back to doing some of those fundamentals better.
Do you think Congresswoman Val Demings has a better shot at beating Senator Marco Rubio next year than the Democrats have at unseating Governor Ron DeSantis?
If you look back at recent history, at least, there's not been a lot of separation between the highest competitive races at the top of the ticket. I mean, 2018, if you look at the governor's race, the Senate race, the ag commissioner's race, et cetera, those races were very tightly bunched. And so I think that Val Demings, who I've known for a long time, is just a phenomenal lady, a phenomenal candidate. She'll bring a different type of energy and different type of race to the ticket than any of the three who are running for governor. But again, I think they all kind of complement each other. And, you know, again, I just suspect that kind of given the politics of the world these days, that I don't see a world, for example, where Val wins the Senate race by a few points and then we lose the governor's race by a few points. Like I just think, you know, in the end, those races are probably going to have pretty similar outcomes.
That was Florida Democratic strategist Steve Shale speaking with Capitol reporter Valerie Crowder. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Valerie Crowder, Robbie Gaffney, Gina Jordan, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. Technical assistance for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.